Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz. Jeff Bennett is away. On the NewsHour tonight, President Biden acknowledges mistakes in last week's debate, but insists he will stay in the race for the White House. We report live from London as exit polls in the United Kingdom show voters likely elected a center-left Labour government after 14 years of center-right conservative rule. And a look back at a Supreme Court term full of consequential and controversial decisions.
This court seems to be very comfortable with the president himself exercising an awful lot of power, perhaps not being as accountable as the founders would have wanted him to be.
Welcome to the NewsHour and happy Independence Day. Well, it's been 1 week since President Joe Biden's poor performance in the first debate of the 2024 campaign caused a political shockwave. The president insists he is staying in the race. But even on this 4th of July holiday, concerns continue to grow inside the Democratic Party about whether Mr. Biden is the best person to sit atop the ticket in November. NewsHour political correspondent Lisa Desjardins has been talking to lawmakers and to voters. She joins me now with the latest. Good to see you, Lisa.
Hi.
So you've been, so far rather, we've seen two Democratic lawmakers come out publicly, only two so far, to publicly call for Mr. Biden to step aside. Your reporting shows that many more could be considering that. Who are we talking about here?
Amna, the texts and phone calls from Democratic lawmakers concerned have not waned in the last week. And talking to about a dozen or so House members in particular and top staffers in Congress who are Democrats in the last couple of days, I can report that there are two movements to write letters asking the president to step aside as the nominee. These are from two groups that are trying to form. One, veteran lawmakers generally who are in safe seats like Lloyd Doggett, who you interviewed here on this program. The other is from frontline members who are much more vulnerable, who believe they have much more to risk if Biden is on the ballot. So these two groups right now are trying to get text together, trying to move these letters ahead. Mm-hmm. Now, would they actually publicly call for the president to do this? Unclear. They're talking about it. How big are these groups? Also unclear. It's very fluid. But I can report from having these conversations that we are talking about scores of House Democrats, not a handful, scores, who want the president privately, they say, to step aside.
So those who think they may step forward to say that, why are they waiting in this moment to do so?
Exactly my question. There are a few reasons. One, wording of the letter is difficult, especially for frontliners. Some of those frontliners, I'm told, would like letter that says he has been a good president. They would like praise for the president in this letter. Other frontliners are nervous about signing that kind of letter because President Biden may not have won in their district before, may not win again. So wording's one issue. Another, of course, is the politics here. There is a lot of calculation about how do you influence this president. Some believe that publicly coming out, asking him to step aside, is exactly the kind of thing that would have this president feel more embattled, more likely to dig in. There's a discussion about that. Then there's also the politics for members. Some are worried that if they come out publicly, there will be retribution later should he win. Some are worried that if they don't come out publicly now, if he loses, there could be retribution for missing this moment.
How does all of this compare to what you're hearing from voters who are watching all this unfold? What are they telling you?
There is a complete disconnect here, Amna. Talking to dozens of voters through our project to reach out to voters, as well as voters in Maine, where I just came back from vacation, family members, and voters here in Virginia this morning at a 4th of July parade, Democratic voters are not just concerned, it's beyond that. Let's take a listen.
I am feeling panicked, certainly like laying in my bed at night, like overcome with fear. I do not think that Joe Biden is the best person to be running in this election. I don't know who that person is, but I don't feel confident in Joe Biden's ability to win this election, and that makes me very afraid.
Now, are there Democrats that still support him, still want him there? Of course there are, but this is the vast majority of the response I'm getting, including a text just in the last hour or so from Darren, undecided voter in Milwaukee, who voted for Biden in 2020. He says he has lost whatever desperate hope he had, and it's well past time for Democrats to face reality about Biden.
Lisa, as you well know, there's been a sense the White House and the campaign have kind of circled the wagons around the president since the debate. He won't sit for his first major interview until tomorrow, more than a week after the debate. How is that playing?
This has been a difficult week for the White House, but they have again and again said, no, he's not stepping aside. And they have been getting their supporters out, as we saw last night when governors from across the country came to the White House. Three of them came up to the microphone to say that they still support the president and that their meeting reinforced that view. And then we had another today, this from a very popular Democratic governor among progressives, Gavin Newsom of California.
There was no one that walked out of that and didn't say, we've got your back, Mr. President. No one. Not one. And so, again, for all the hand-wringing, all the navel-gazing, time to step up and step in.
That is, again, a disconnect from what I'm hearing from Democrats here in Washington, who actually are angry, especially House Democrats, for two reasons. One, the campaign came after them in the last week, calling them bedwetters. They say that ignores the reality. They think there is a real political problem here for Biden that they're ignoring, and potentially a governing one. They are concerned about what he will be like in 3 years. So where does this leave all of this? A lot of those House Democrats who are figuring out how they express concern, and do they, are waiting for a big interview tomorrow. President Biden speaking to ABC. Time is of the essence, and this may be the most important interview of his political career.
All right, Lisa Desjardins with the latest on this ongoing story. Lisa, thank you.
Welcome.
In the day's other headlines, Hurricane Beryl is now a Category 2 storm, down from a Category 5, but it remains powerful as it churns towards Mexico. At least 9 people have been killed across the region. In Jamaica, Beryl knocked down trees and power lines as it brushed the island's southern coast. And in the eastern Caribbean, 95% of homes on a pair of islands in St. Vincent and the Grenadines have been damaged or destroyed. While in Barbados, boats were tossed like toys. Sailors say there's likely even more destruction beneath the surf.
All the vessels in here have damage. All have damage. Structural damage, but we got a good few vessels that is underwater. We don't know how much the total is right now, but we estimate about 30 or maybe 40 vessels is under the water.
The National Hurricane Center expects Beryl to weaken further, but to remain a dangerous hurricane until it reaches Mexico's shores tomorrow. Southern Texas is forecast to see impacts from Beryl early next week. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told President Biden today that he's sending a delegation to renew ceasefire talks with Hamas. The two spoke by phone after Hamas sent a response to a three-phase proposal pushed by the U.S., Israel, and other nations. In the meantime, northern Israeli hillsides are ablaze amid heavy rocket fire from Hezbollah in Lebanon. The group says it's launched hundreds of projectiles in response to Israel's killing of one of its top commanders. At the funeral for Mohammed Nameh Nasser today in Beirut, a Hezbollah leader vowed that the retaliation will continue.
The response to the assassination of our dear leader Abu Nameh began last night and quickly. The series of responses is targeting new sites the enemy never imagined would be hit.
Israel has not reported any casualties. The Israeli Defense Forces say it struck back today, hitting Hezbollah military structures in southern Lebanon. Russian President Vladimir Putin ruled out a ceasefire in Ukraine until Kyiv takes steps that are, quote, irreversible and acceptable to the Russian Federation. Putin made the comment in Kazakhstan on the final day of a regional security conference. He also weighed in on the U.S. election, particularly former President Trump's repeated claims that if reelected, he could end the fighting in Ukraine in a single day.
The fact that Mr. Trump declares that he is ready and wants to stop the war in Ukraine, we take this quite seriously. I am not, of course, familiar with his possible proposals regarding how he is going to do this, but I have no doubt that he means it sincerely, and we will support it.
In the meantime, Ukraine's military said its troops retreated from the outskirts of Chasiv Yar. It's a town in the eastern Donetsk region. Commanders say Russia has deployed scorched earth tactics there for months. Its fall would put nearby cities in jeopardy and threaten critical Ukrainian supply routes. A court in Moscow convicted U.S. citizen Robert Woodland of drug-related charges today. He was sentenced to 12 and a half years in prison. Woodland, who was born in Russia, was in court today to hear his sentence. He's one of a growing number of Americans arrested in Russia as relations between the two nations sink to Cold War lows. His lawyers say Woodland has been suffering from unspecified mental health issues. They plan to appeal the verdict. The International Swimming Federation says its executive director has been ordered to testify in a U.S. criminal probe into alleged doping by Chinese Olympic swimmers. American officials want to know how 23 Chinese swimmers were allowed to compete in the 2021 Tokyo Olympics despite testing positive for a banned heart medication. It comes just 3 weeks ahead of the Olympic Games in Paris, where 11 of those same athletes are set to compete. Millions across America have been celebrating the July 4th holiday, and it's been a hot one. 134 million people in the South and in the West have been under heat alerts. That didn't stop the celebrations, of course, with parades and cookouts across the nation. On New York's Coney Island, the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest gobbled on today without 16-time champion Joey Chestnut, who couldn't compete because of a sponsorship conflict. Instead, Patrick Bertoletti of Chicago took the men's title, downing 58 dogs in 10 minutes. And defending women's champion Miki Sudo retained her crown, eating a women's record of 51 francs. And for all of you salad eaters out there, here's a fun fact. This July 4th also happens to be the 100th birthday of the Caesar salad. The culinary staple has its roots not in America, but in Tijuana, Mexico. That is where, in 1924, an Italian immigrant named Cesar Cardini is said to have thrown together some leftover ingredients after his hungry patrons emptied the shelves. The result was the dish that we know and love today. So, something for everyone this July 4th. Still to come on the NewsHour. Billions of dollars in federal pandemic aid for schools help students catch up academically, but gaps remain. A look at an effort underway in Missouri to enshrine abortion access in the state's constitution. And the climate cost of artificial intelligence and the energy required to power it.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Exit polls in the United Kingdom show a Labour landslide in today's election, with the centre-left party winning a massive majority in Parliament in the first general election in nearly 5 years. This video from Sky TV shows the results of those exit polls. The Conservatives' loss marks the end of 14 years in power and Rishi Sunak's prime ministership. Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer will be Britain's next prime minister. NewsHour special correspondent Malcolm Brabant is in London covering the election and joins us now. So, Malcolm, what more can you tell us about these results? Were they a surprise or to be expected?
No, people were saying right at the start that the election was called, that it was over virtually then. That people were expecting a substantial Labour majority because the nation really has declared that it's sick and tired of the Conservatives. And this has been borne out tonight. These early exit polls are usually extremely accurate, and what they're saying is that Labour will have 410 seats in the 365-seat parliament, giving them a majority of 170 seats, and the Conservatives have lost 241 seats, which is one of the worst performances by a Conservative government in recent political history.
So a landslide victory, it seems like, there. What does that margin of victory mean, both for the Labour Party and how Sir Keir Starmer's priorities can actually be put into place?
Well, this is exactly what he wanted to be able to carry out all of his legislative programs. And he's been rather vague about some of the things that he's going to do. But he now has, you know, absolutely really no opposition to worry about when it comes to putting through the things that he wants to do. And that is basically trying to get growth, stabilising the economy. He wants to improve the National Health Service. He also wants to set up border controls to stop a new sort of border force to stop all of the boat people coming across from France. And he also wants to bring in new teachers and things like that. And the Conservatives have concerns that what he might even do with this supermajority is to introduce voting for 16-year-olds so that Labour can stay in power for generations. We'll have to wait and see if that one comes true. But certainly there's been a lot of scaremongering by the Conservatives about what this is going to do with such a powerful majority for Sir Keir.
Malcolm, what about those Conservatives? After 14 years in power, where does this leave the Conservative Party and Rishi Sunak?
Well, they're in total disarray. This is, you know, a dreadful performance on their part. And, you know, I mean, they have been... They've suffered as a result, you know, of there being COVID and also of there being a war in Ukraine, but also their own irresponsibility in government and incompetence has been one of the things that's actually brought about their demise. Rishi Sunak is thought to be a sort of very nice guy, a technocrat, pretty and pretty competent, but he's just not been able to get over the kind of history that the people of this country have with the Conservatives. And after 14 years of it, people have just had enough. Even though they don't particularly sort of trust everything Keir Starmer says, they just want change. They're fed up with the cost of living being, you know, absolutely abominable. And one of the things, for example, that Keir Starmer is going to do, which the Conservatives would never do, is to hit the Labour, is to hit the oil companies with extra revenue, with all the profits they've been making, and to pour that into green energy. And that's, people are fed up with their bills for gas and electricity going up, and they just want change.
Malcolm, there's another political force at play here. That is a man named Nigel Farage. Many people may know the leader of the right-wing populist party, Reform UK. Where did he come out in this race?
Well, he's done pretty well. I mean, we don't know just how many votes he's managed to get, and he's only going to get 13 seats by the looks of things in Parliament. But he's basically setting himself up for 5 years' time. I mean, he's going to be a rabble-rouser in Parliament. He's going to be the loudest voice, possibly, against Keir Starmer. And what he's going to be trying to do is to unite the right wing behind him, so that in 5 years' time, he'll be in a position to challenge Keir Starmer, perhaps as Prime Minister. But that's going to be his main role. And I think he'll be quite content with what he's got, because if he wins his seat in Eastern England, he'll be in Parliament and he'll be a thorn in Keir Starmer's side.
All right, that is NewsHour special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reporting live for us from London tonight. Malcolm, thank you. Good to see you. The nine justices of the Supreme Court considered more than 60 cases this term before rendering their final decisions earlier this week. Their rulings on abortion access, presidential immunity, and the limits of federal agencies could have long-lasting impacts. They also showcased sharp divides among the justices. I sat down with two Supreme Court watchers to reflect on this historic term. Steve Vladek is a professor at Georgetown University's Law Center, and Joan Biskupic is CNN's senior Supreme Court analyst and author of the book Nine Black Robes. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Joan, start us off here, and let's begin with what was easily the court's most anticipated decision on Monday, deciding that presidents are entitled to some immunity from prosecution. How consequential is that decision, given how it could reshape the presidency?
Consequential for this year, but consequential for many, many years. This was such a robust reading of executive power. It was a very bold statement by this court, this 6-3 supermajority conservative court. So I think it gave us a new insight into the court under John Roberts. And in terms of going forward, it's certainly already affecting prosecutions against former President Donald Trump and will affect presidential powers and authority down the road.
Steve, this undeniably leaves us with a more powerful executive after that decision. How does that decision square with the trend you saw from the justices and how they viewed the power of executive branch agencies in other decisions?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Amna, it makes sense if you distinguish between the power of the presidency as an institution versus the power of executive branch agencies. This court seems to be very comfortable with the president himself exercising an awful lot of power, perhaps not being as accountable as the founders would have wanted him to be, while still reigning in the power of lower level agencies and reigning in the power of Congress to even give authority to those agencies, that might seem like a tension at first. I actually think it has the same core goal, which is enhancing the power of the presidency, enhancing the role of the courts, and actually weakening as much as any other institution in American government, the legislature.
And Joan, as we know, the issue of abortion loomed large over this term as well, 2 years after the Dobbs decision overturned that constitutional right to abortions. But this court basically punted on two related cases that came before them, one related to abortion medication, the other on access to emergency abortions. How did you look at those decisions?
Well, the first one, the one that ensured that women would still have access to mifepristone, the abortion medication, that was a logical outcome when they said the challengers there, the anti-abortion physicians who didn't even engage in any kind of abortion or prescription of this drug, that they didn't have what's known as legal standing, that they couldn't bring that case. The other case from Idaho involving the ability to get emergency abortions for women who had complications in pregnancies, mm-hmm. that one was a surprise. First of all, it was a surprise even the way the justices took it. They reached out to take that case. They allowed this Idaho law, a complete ban, to take effect. They sidestepped that mm-hmm. with an unusual compromise in the end, but I think that compromise that they had, saying that they were going to put it off for a while, that they should not have granted it in the first place, that they shouldn't have reached out, I think it just showed, though, that they're kind of chomping at the bit to have a night of their bite at a case that could really diminish access to abortion, what's left of it after they've rolled back constitutional abortion rights.
And Steve, you've noted in your analysis before that when the justices weren't unanimous in their decisions, we often saw this 6-3 split, which is clearly along ideological lines. What does that say to you about the evolution of this Roberts Court?
Well, I think what's striking, Amna, is remember that the justices are choosing virtually all of their cases. And so it's not like this is a random cross-section of cases from lower courts that are just happening to split them ideologically. Yeah. What it shows, and I think what the Idaho abortion case shows, is that the six conservative justices know what they want to do and are taking the cases where they are going to be able to stake out what really are, in the main, ideological positions that are going to provoke the dissents of the three Democratic appointees. You know, we shouldn't be surprised by that, but I think it's striking that there were twice as many of those 6-3 ideological splits this year as last term. It suggests, as in the Idaho case, the court is just taking whatever the conservatives want to take, even if in some of these cases it is coming to regret that down the road.
I also wanted to ask what you make of some of the tone we've seen in the dissents in these cases from those liberal justices. And what do you make of that? We've seen a stronger language there.
Certainly stronger language, and it was escalating. It had been building on the part of Justice Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, our newest justice. The anger, the passion, and I felt like when I was hearing some of those earlier dissents, it revealed what was to come. They just are not able to make any kind of inroads. The six-justice conservative majority is really flexing its muscle. And I think Steve and I have observed that there is such a difference between a five-justice conservative majority and six because they've got wiggle room. Somebody can drop off and they can still be pretty bold in where they're going toward the right.
Steve, we should also note this is a court that's faced the same decline in public trust that all other American institutions have seen. Pew Research tracked a more than 30-point drop in Supreme Court's favorable rating since 1987. That was as of summer of 2023. And then we saw this slew of reports, many from ProPublica, raising questions about ethics concerns. The court adopted an ethics code late last year. But how do you look at that? Can they win back the public's trust?
I mean, yes, they can. I don't know that anything the court has done in the last couple of weeks has been in any way taking steps in that direction. And, you know, it's really striking. Joan mentioned the voices of the three liberal dissenters. I think we've also heard the emerging voice of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. She is marking out position in between herself and the other conservative justices, where I think she actually is perhaps the most cognizant of the need to not look like they're jumping the gun. In the Colorado ballot disqualification case, she wrote specifically about what message the court was sending to the American people. She seems worried about that. The problem, as Joan points out, is there are now six, and so one's not enough. The fact that Chief Justice Roberts has really gone more over to the Thomas Alito Gorsuch wing is part of why I think we're going to see this credibility gap continue to grow.
We have described this term as historic so many times I have lost count. But Joan, how would you briefly sort of describe the impact of some of their decisions and how you look ahead to the next term?
Where it was a turning point, I think, is in the immunity decision. The justices' regard for the presidency and the justices' regard for themselves, you know, even though they certainly protected the executive branch much more than any court has ever in American history. It also leaves to the court itself. What are official acts? What are not official acts? Which is the crucial question coming out of the immunity thing. You know, we talk about the imperial presidency. There was a certain imperial kind of oomph to what the justices did for the judiciary. And also, I think, for John Roberts. Steve mentioned that Amy Coney Barrett is a little bit more in the center than how we would have regarded John Roberts once upon a time. John Roberts in this immunity case, in the regulatory movement of the justices against protections for environment, for labor, for public health, mm-hmm. He has really shown himself to be much more vigorous in moving to the right and enforcing a certain kind of conservative agenda that he started his career with in Washington when he first worked in the Reagan administration.
Steve, what about you? How do you reflect back on this term and what are you looking for in the next?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that this term saw the most aggressive restructuring of the federal government since the New Deal, since 1937, when we had a slew of Supreme Court decisions that really had helped to set the stage for the modern administrative state. Whether that restructuring is going to be a good thing in the long term, Amna, very much remains to be seen. The early returns are not especially inspiring. And looking ahead to next term, they know as much as anyone that there's an election coming in November. And how we are talking and looking at the Supreme Court next year is going to depend a heck of a lot, I think, on who wins in November and on whether we have, you know, a second Trump administration, where the question is how much will that court stand up to a President Trump, or, you know, Joe Biden or another Democrat wins in November and we have more of the same. I think that's really very much all to play for. The problem is that the real watchword, the real takeaway, is all of these decisions in the cumulative are going to destabilize settled understandings of law, are going to destabilize the power of the federal government. And in the long term, Joan's right, it's about the imperial judiciary and how much more judges are going to be deciding features of our everyday lives.
All right. That is Steve Vladeck and Joan Biskupic. Thank you so much for your time and for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's well known that there were some big gaps in student learning tied to school shutdowns during the pandemic and difficult transitions with hybrid classes. But a big question remains: how much did federal aid help students recover from those academic losses? We now have some answers from new research, and Jeffrey Brown dives into the latest.
A pair of new studies show that the $190 billion the federal government gave in pandemic aid for schools help students catch up academically, but big gaps remain. Here to tell us about them is Laura Meckler, national education writer for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Laura. So in general terms, first, we did see some gains, even if moderate. Tell us about it.
Yes, we did see some gains. There were deep losses from the pandemic between 2019 and 2022. And we just saw those were across the board. Rich districts, poor districts, but especially poor districts saw big, steep losses. But we did start to see some improvement between 2022 and spring of 2023. We don't yet have the results from this last testing in spring 2024, so we don't know. But obviously, people are hoping that they'll see continued improvement then. But as of what we know right now, kids are still behind.
So that's a lot of money to spend. What kind of specific steps made the most difference? Do we know?
Well, unfortunately, we don't really know, because they wanted that money out the door and there were very few strings attached. Districts were not required to say how they were spending the money, and districts used it for a wide range of purposes. Now, let's remember that in the spring of 2021, when this money was first allocated, people were talking about reopening schools, and there was money spent on nurses, there was money spent on COVID testing, on ventilation systems. Some school districts used money for facilities improvements. But then it became clearer over, you know, pretty quickly it became clear that really the biggest problems American schools were facing was this loss of learning, this academic regression. So there were definitely money spent on that, on tutoring, on summer programs, on additional staff to help maybe put another teacher in the room to go around and help kids who are struggling with a problem.
Now, my understanding is that poorer districts got more of the aid. Did differences show up between poorer and better off school systems?
Yeah, they did. And even more interestingly enough, with among poor districts, some poor districts got more money than others due to a quirk in the formula that they used in distributing this aid. So researchers were able to really look and see what impact did the aid have. Now, everybody improved, but, you know, was it that they were going to improve anyway, or do we credit this federal money? And what they were able to determine was that for every $1,000 that was spent per pupil, they saw about 3% of a grade improvement. So, you know, is that a lot or a little? I guess it kind of depends on whether you're feeling like this glass is you know, 3% full or maybe 50% empty, but they did in fact have an impact.
And to be clear, when you talk about grade improvement, we're talking about math or reading scores, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so that's in math scores. If we're looking at math in particular, what we found was that there was a drop in student test scores between 2019 and 2022 of about half a grade in math. So students lost about half a grade's worth of learning in math. And so they needed to like catch up by quite a bit. And because you need to learn the new material for the next year that you're in school, plus what you lost from the previous year. So that was a huge challenge. And so again, this, if you're thinking about say a 50% loss of a half a grade, you know, for every $1,000 spent, 3% improvement. So if you spent say $8,000 per student in this pandemic aid, you would get maybe a quarter of a grade improvement.
Now this federal funding is coming to an end soon, right? What happens then? What are you hearing from schools themselves?
Districts do have to spend the money by this fall, and there are a lot of concerns about cutbacks that will come with that. Some districts are intent on trying to maintain as much of the new interventions that they put in place as possible, but in other places, they are definitely facing cuts. For instance, in the city of Cleveland, they developed a robust summer program that served more than 5,000 kids a year for the last few years, but this summer they only have about half that many enrolled because they just don't have funding for the full program.
So just summing up as we end here, with all the talk about these gaps and the losses and studies like this, how much do we know at this point?
Well, you know, we know a good bit. We know that the losses were steep. We know that the comeback is underway, but we just don't know how far we've gotten yet. And it'll be one thing I'll be looking for, and a lot of people will be looking for, is what were those test scores this last spring, just a couple months ago? You know, how much of an improvement did we see? Did we see another big jump like we did from 22 to 2023? Or did the pace of improvement lag? So I think that there's still a bit that we don't know, but we certainly know that the American education system has been trying to make up for these deep losses. And now that the money is gone, we'll just have to see, will there be further sliding or will they find a way to continue helping kids catch up to where they're supposed to be?
All right, Laura Meckler of the Washington Post, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
In Missouri, abortion was banned almost immediately after Roe v. Wade was overturned. Now, 2 years later, there's an effort to enshrine abortion access in the state's constitution by putting it on the ballot this election cycle. I recently spoke to our community's correspondent, Gabrielle Hayes, in St. Louis. Gabby, great to see you. Help us understand here now, in the 2 years since Dobbs was overturned, what has that meant for people in Missouri and providers in the surrounding areas?
You know, Amna, a lot of what we know about how this has impacted Missouri and what this looks like for Missourians comes from the data and the information that we're able to gather from other states who are monitoring, you know, how many people are coming from states with more extreme bans, such as Missouri, how those folks are being impacted. We got some data from Hope Clinic this week. That clinic is located in Illinois, right across the river from St. Louis. And providers there tell us that 80% of the patients that they are seeing are coming from states with more extreme bans. They say they are seeing patients coming from 28 different states across the country, five countries from around the world. We were able to speak to Julie Burkhart over at Hope Clinic, who was able to kind of paint the picture for what this impact looks like for patients coming to their clinic for care.
Oftentimes, they have to bring their children because they don't have childcare or don't feel that they can disclose to people why they would need to maybe leave their children for a day or two. People go to great lengths to get rides from friends, to get a bus ticket, to get on a plane.
Now, Burkhart explained for just a bit of context that just last month alone, 48% of the patients that they saw, she says, came from the state of Missouri.
Gabby, we did see in other states like Michigan and Ohio, in reaction to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, people launching successful ballot initiatives where voters then get to decide on abortion access in their own states. Tell us about the effort in Missouri.
Yeah, Amma, there is an effort currently unfolding here in the state of Missouri. Missourians for Constitutional Freedom launched a campaign in hopes to get abortion on the ballot this fall. Advocates who work with that campaign tell us that they were able to get the amount of signatures, in fact, twice as many, in order to get on the ballot. We were able to talk to Tori Schaefer, who is an attorney for the ACLU, but also works on the campaign, to kind of explain to us what getting abortion on the ballot could mean for the state of Missouri.
Missouri is unique in the sense that we're going to show states across the country that regardless of the political dynamics in your state, folks are with you. And it's not a decision that's made on political party or who's at the top of the ticket in your state. This is an issue that is very personal, and we know that Missourians are with us.
Schaefer pointed out specifically that the impact would be substantial, given, as I stated earlier, that Missouri, outlawed abortion so quickly after Dobbs and has one of the more stricter bans.
And Gabby, we know that there is a Republican majority in the Missouri state legislature. Has there been any pushback to that effort?
Yeah, there definitely has been, but I think a little context is important. So, we saw state Republican legislators putting forth legislation this year in hopes to make it harder to amend the state's constitution. I had some Republicans telling me earlier this year that they felt like it was too easy for people to be able to change the state's constitution. Now, that bill didn't go very far, but when we talk about this in terms of abortion specifically being on the ballot, legislators have taken to social media, Republicans encouraging people to not sign the petition back when signatures are being collected, encouraging people to what they call decline to sign. And so we've seen a little bit of that. But to zoom out a little bit, earlier this week, I spoke to United States Senator Josh Hawley, who spoke to me a little bit about this issue. And he told me, though he is pro-life, he said, the people should be able to vote if it gets to that point and it gets on the ballot. He essentially said that the people should have the opportunity to debate on it if that is what they want to do.
So, Gabby, what about some context here? I mean, what are we seeing nationwide on this issue? Is abortion on the ballot in other states?
Yeah, it definitely is, Amna, and this is something that we're learning more about this week. Just for a little bit of context, we know that at least six states will have some type of abortion access language on the ballot come this fall. That's states like Nevada and Florida. But we also know that about five of them, at least five other states, have some sort of pending ballot measures that we're waiting to see if they make it on the ballot. Those are states like Missouri, but also Arizona. We did get some news this week that both Arizona and Nebraska, that organizers and advocates there say that they have submitted and they have enough signatures, in some cases twice as many, to be able to get on the ballot. So we are just waiting to see, and for Missouri specifically, advocates tell us that they believe that we should know whether or not it'll make it on the ballot in August.
All right. That is our communities correspondent in St. Louis, Gabrielle Hayes. Gabby, thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Google announced this week it is well behind on a pledge to all but eliminate its net carbon emissions by 2030. Its emissions are actually up nearly 50% since 2019. One factor, artificial intelligence and the energy required to power it via the company's massive data centers. As economics correspondent Paul Solman reports, the AI arms race has experts worried about its climate consequences.
By now, you've probably seen ChatGPT, which economist Simon Johnson prompted to substitute for me in a recent story.
Good evening. I'm Paul Solman, reporting on a compelling new analysis that's stirring debate in economic circles.
Now meet Mary, a chatbot avatar companion created recently for us on the app Replica. She's connected to ChatGPT, but can also flirt on her own.
Are you always this irresistible?
And finally, here's 3D Amica.
Albert Camus, in his book Le Mythe de Sisyphe, The Myth of Sisyphus, writes, "On peut être vertueux par caprice."
On peut être vertueux par caprice translates to one can be virtuous out of caprice. Camus suggests that virtue need not stem from deeper philosophies or moral systems.
Amica, too, is hooked up to ChatGPT. How quickly can Amica respond?
15 milliseconds. That's how long it took.
Which is extraordinary, but the next question would be, how much energy does it take to make that whole process work from ChatGPT to a robot and back?
A whole lot, says research professor Kate Crawford, and that poses a threat.
What I'm most worried about is that we're building an enormous infrastructure for artificial intelligence that is extremely energy and water intensive without looking at the very real downsides in terms of the climate impacts.
Like more brownouts in Texas, say, wildfires in California, stronger hurricanes in the Gulf, 126 degrees in Delhi this spring. Data centers had already been burgeoning with the internet and the so-called cloud of data storage and exchange.
Then we suddenly had cryptocurrency mining adding a lot on top of that.
Amsterdam-based data scientist Alex de Vries. And as the value of cryptocurrency has multiplied, so have the data centers, like those that mine Bitcoin in cheap energy havens like Plattsburgh, New York.
This miner here will use as much power as my house does a month.
Says de Vries.
AI might be going in the exact same direction.
And notes Crawford, AI is not just going to stress the electricity grid.
These large-scale data centers, they use GPUs that are enormously heat-producing. And the water to cool these GPU chips is fresh water. So it's often coming from exactly the same reserves that are used for drinking water.
These are basically customer deployments where they're running their critical infrastructure and their applications.
Bill Strong runs the data centers in Silicon Valley for Equinix, which operates 260 of the nearly 11,000 centers that operate worldwide. The company leases space to firms like AT&T and Google Cloud to run servers that power their cloud and AI operations. And Equinix is expanding.
This is where AI-like processors would go?
Correct. This is a high-density deployment. Liquid cooled. So basically we're taking the building's chilled water, it comes into here, each one of these goes to an actual chip on a customer server.
These are nozzles?
Correct. There's nozzles where there's a little ancillary tube that connects to the server, cools the chip, the hot air comes back, ties into our chilled water system, gets cooled, and that's how we're able to provide liquid cooling for these higher density AI type deployments.
This Silicon Valley complex alone features 345,000 square feet of servers, thousands of them, operating 24/7. The company's global energy budget, as of last year, same as 750,000 U.S. homes. And what fraction of global energy use do the world's 11,000 or so data centers use?
We've had estimates from, 2 to 8%.
But even at the low end,
2% is around the same energy budget as the Netherlands.
And if, as widely predicted, that doubles in 2 years,
we could see the energy budget be as high as a country the size of Japan.
Even now, a data center complex in Iowa, owned and operated by Meta, uses as much power per year as 7 million laptops running 8 hours a day. And of course, We're in the very early days of artificial intelligence. But as AI taketh away, it may also giveth. Christopher Wellis runs sustainability at Equinix.
What we don't know yet, for example, is what will be the benefits to society from a energy perspective.
Such as?
Air Canada is a customer of Equinix, and we're able to optimize their flight pathways and save fuel for them as a company. A lot of focus is on how much energy that AI is going to use, but the energy that's consumed, for instance, in training these large language models is not lost. You can think of it as stored energy. Once these models are trained, if they're retained, they can be used over and over and over again.
There are some signs that give me hope.
Even Kate Crawford agrees.
Researchers are now investigating different sorts of technical architectures, in particular what are called small language models. These are models that use much less data and therefore less energy. We're also starting to see regulators pay attention. We've seen the first bill be brought into Congress, which is looking specifically at AI's environmental impacts.
The solar panels are supplying 0.5 megawatt of power.
Case in point, Equinix itself.
When the solar panels are active, we're not pulling from the local utility source.
Okay, these panels fuel a mere 3% of the facility so far. But with solar capacity doubling every 3 years, maybe the sky's the limit.
Ultimately, I think that will all be very net positive.
Techno-optimist Reid Hoffman, the creator of LinkedIn, puts his faith in AI itself.
A much earlier version, 10 years ago, when it was applied to data centers, figured out how to save power in data centers by 15% in the ongoing week-by-week operation of the data center. So you go, well, if we're generating AIs that can help us with this kind of thing, sure, it takes a bunch of electricity to train, but then it helps us figure out how to operate our electrical grids much better. Right? And that's already line of sight today. So ultimately, I think the electricity worries is more of a red herring.
Really?
Yes.
But near term, warns Kate Crawford,
it's inevitable that we're going to see price increases if we continue to have these sorts of pressures on the electrical grid.
And so the age-old horse race between the costs of new technology and its benefits. In the case of AI, perhaps, to solve the problems it creates, or not so much. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman in Silicon Valley.
The American flag is one of the world's most recognizable symbols, but the responses it provokes are anything but uniform. A museum exhibit in Arkansas explores how such a universal symbol can send so many different messages. In this Encore report, Allie Rogan paid a visit for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
It flies over the halls of justice. It's used to mark a solemn sacrifice, and it's wrapped around shoulders in celebration. It's present at the proudest and the darkest moments in the nation's history. The flag represents America, but it can't represent all the experiences of those who claim it as their own. That's the idea behind the exhibit flagged for discussion at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Every object here reflects the artist's personal relationship or connection to the flag.
Curator Larissa Randall came up with the idea for the exhibit while perusing items in the museum's permanent collection. There were so many depictions of the American flag, but each was so different. Like this Norman Rockwell portrait of Rosie the Riveter quite literally eating Hitler's lunch. Or this wood carving by Leroy Allman, making clear that the transatlantic slave trade also took place under the flag's auspices. Or Ward by George Tooker, in which the flag provides little comfort to ailing patients.
I was struck by how artists from across time, across walks of life, of various backgrounds, all use the flag to like comment on issues that are important to them.
This is a flag, Mexico and the U.S. as one, but it's bigger than that. It's can't we get along?
For artist Consuelo Jimenez Underwood, the flag is both message and medium. Underwood was born in Sacramento, California. Her mother was third-generation Mexican-American, and her father was part of the Bracero program, which allowed Mexican seasonal workers to come to the United States during both World Wars. Her piece at Crystal Bridges is called Home of the Brave. It combines the American and Mexican flags, evoking the strong ties between the two countries, but also the deep divides.
I feel that the threads can join not just fabric, but people. And that's where I came in. I wanted to do something about the division between our countries, Mexico and U.S. For me, that line is very arbitrary.
Like many children of migrants at the time, Underwood grew up picking crops with her family, taxing her small body. But with the help of her parents, she nurtured her spirit and mind.
I learned how to appreciate the little that I had from my dad. And it was the hottest, picking tomatoes in Sacramento Valley, 110 degrees. It was hard. And he would sing, and everybody would listen, because he had a beautiful voice. The other magic that happened in those fields in those early years were the book vans that came to the fields for us kids that would miss school the first 2 months and the last 2 months of the school year. And I made a promise to myself, because I'm getting behind, I swear I will not read fiction. I'm only going to read biography, science, real stuff, so that I can make up for the knowledge that I'm losing.
America allowed children like Underwood to labor alongside adults, a practice that continues illegally today. But as Underwood sees it, America also allowed her to thrive.
I lived under the U.S. flag, and I knew if I got an education, I could move up the social economic. So Consuelo, don't cry. You'll be the first of 11 of 12 to get that high school education.
She finds inspiration in the methods of the indigenous Huichol people of Mexico, from whom she is descended. Her flag rests on a backdrop of intricate indigenous designs.
Underneath is a really important history that, don't forget, it's the shoulders that we stand on.
Her flag features raw materials like plastic and barbed wires. Safety pins hold the two flags' loose threads together.
This flag is in disarray because it's not perfect. But it's beautiful because the land that it waves over is wonderful.
What does it mean to you to have this work in conversation with the other pieces in this exhibit?
It really is wonderful. I feel like Crystal Bridges is embodying the best of these artworks that make you jump. Go, oh my God, I've never seen something like that.
I would see this project as successful if someone left thinking about the flag in a different way than they walked in.
That's the exhibit's other common thread, each piece's ability to provoke deeper thought.
It makes me proud. It makes me also thoughtful of our history and how far we've come in expanding our civil rights.
As my cap shows, I was in the service in the Army, so the flag to me is the flag, freedom, because that's what I went in for, to fight for.
It's kind of twisted now, I feel like, with the flag. How free are we really, you know, when you really think about it?
Some people might look at the U.S. flag and see unity or fear or harmony or freedom, and whatever people see, I think, is valid, but also is worth investigating. Whose freedom are we talking about here, and how, as we move forward as a country, what do we want this to sort of represent for us now?
Flagged for Discussion doesn't answer those questions, but it starts the conversation. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Allie Rogan in Bentonville, Arkansas.
And before we go, a reminder to stick around for PBS's very own July 4th concert. A Capitol 4th features performances from musical guests and fireworks from the nation's capital. That is tonight on PBS, and check your local listings. Remember, there's always a lot more online at pbs.org/newshour, including a live stream of tonight's Capitol 4th concert and fireworks. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us, and happy 4th.